Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We're living in the economic fault line, you know. What the future is going to look like is going to be based on how people feel right now. So today on the program, how people are feeling. Some new data from the Marketplace Edison Research poll coming at you from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 5th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to dig into some of that data from the newest Marketplace Edison Research poll that is out today in just a sec. But it occurs to me that before we get there, maybe we need to explain why. Now, especially, we need to know what's going on in the real economy, the one that we're all living and working and quarantined in. We need to know because there's a disconnect out there. Right, between what people are experiencing and what the markets and, yes, some politicians are saying. Yes, regular people, they'll tell you. Stephanie Silverman's part of our series, The United States of Work. She runs a theater down in Nashville, Tennessee.
It's hard to get your head around using your emergency funds, but if not now, when? So we're spending them down.
Here's a distinctly not regular person, Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. He says basically the same thing.
I think everyone is suffering here. But I think those who are least able to bear it are the ones who are losing their jobs and losing their incomes and have little cushion to protect them in times like that.
Point is, what the future is going to look like, as I said, is being decided right now. So we wanted to know how people are feeling right now. So to the poll, one of the things that always jumps out when we do this poll is how precarious people's finances are. We asked, and have for a couple of polls the past couple of years, how difficult it would be to pay an unexpected expense of $1,000. Almost 60% of people said they would have a hard time swinging that. This time, though, we added a question in that section. What about an unexpected expense of $250? More than 40% of our respondents said they would struggle with that. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams takes it from there.
One of the people who responded to our survey was 66-year-old Thomas Benton in St. Louis, Missouri. He's a district manager for a fast food restaurant, and in the midst of the pandemic, he went from working about 50 hours a week to about 30.
My financial outlook now is very bleak.
He says he definitely couldn't pay an unexpected expense of $1,000, and probably not $250 either.
No, because I couldn't even get $300 this morning. It's kind of rough.
He needed that $300 for rent this month. Normally, he might call friends and family to help in an emergency, but they're in the same boat. Sarah Saddlemeyer at Pew Charitable Trusts says even in normal times, many people would struggle to absorb a big unexpected expense. Now,
more families are out of work or are living paycheck to paycheck or are doing work and childcare, and so even small unexpected expenses can really throw a wrench in families' balance sheets.
For a lot of people, COVID-19 is the unexpected expense, with sudden job losses highlighting just how unstable financial stability can be. Lissa Johnson is with Washington University's Center for Social Development.
So not only do they not have savings, but they don't even have income. So they don't have the income even to replenish any savings that they did have.
In our poll, certain groups seem much more cushioned against this economic shock than others. 27% of white respondents say an unexpected expense of $250 would be difficult, compared to 50% of Hispanics and 59% of African Americans, like Thomas Benton in St. Louis.
So now I got to use when I get paid next week. I got to get caught up for this week. It's kind of hectic.
The kind of situation that creates economic anxiety at any time and even more during a pandemic. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Through the rest of the program today, what parts of our economic future might look like from where we sit now here in the Fault Line. Wall Street was up today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Time has been the differentiator for this crisis, right? Things went so far south so fast. Now, time is becoming an issue as assorted states and businesses try to start getting back to whatever the new normal is going to be. Specifically, how long are essential businesses going to keep paying their essential employees for the extra risks those employees are taking? Hazard pay when the hazard has no obvious end. Here's Marketplace's Kristen Schwab.
Rashad Lloyd started working at a Total Wine & More in Springfield, Virginia in March, right when the pandemic heated up. The job paid $14 an hour with an extra $2 an hour as hazard pay.
Even though it wasn't a tremendous amount, it meant that, hey, we see what you're doing, we appreciate what you're doing. But when they stopped it, it was like, whoa.
The bonus ended on April 12th. But you know what hasn't ended? The threat of the virus.
I mean, I'm extraordinarily worried about personal risk. But I need to work. I need to bring in some income.
Total Wine & More says the hazard pay was meant to be temporary to match an increase in store traffic. Other retailers like Target have promised hazard pay through the end of May. Many businesses aren't giving them at all. Heidi Scherholtz at the Economic Policy Institute says in normal times, jobs that suddenly become more dangerous would naturally pay more. But these aren't normal times, and jobs aren't easy to come by.
So if an employer was providing hazard pay and then stopped providing it, there's very little an employee could do.
Of course, grocery store workers didn't sign up for their jobs thinking they'd be putting themselves in danger. But Scherholtz says store owners didn't expect it either.
You did not picture that you would need to be paying your workers hazard pay because it wasn't on your radar that this could become an extremely dangerous job.
Most businesses don't have a disaster plan for a global pandemic, especially small businesses, which tend to have less cash reserves. Jake Caberly owns a grocery store in Traverse City, Michigan. His employees start at $11 an hour, and he's added a $2 hazard pay with no end date.
It was definitely the right thing to do, but can have a wild impact on my bottom line.
He says he'll keep paying the bonus as long as sales stay strong, or until he thinks things are less risky for his workers. He thinks he can sustain it for a couple more months.
The safety issue is a big barometer.
But how will Caberly decide when things are safe? He says when Michigan reopens non-essential businesses. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
All the news about businesses closing their doors obscures a little bit of reality. There's a whole world of startups out there, pandemic or no, that are trying to make a go of it. Arlen Hamilton is the founder and managing partner of Backstage Capital. That's a venture capital firm that invests in founders from groups that are underrepresented in the all-important world of VC, people of color, women, and LGBTQ people as well. Her book about how she does what she does is called It's About Damn Time. Arlen, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You write in this book, and this is a great line, I think, the underrepresented are likely to be underestimated. How does that play out in the world of venture capital as you see it?
Yeah, I mean, more than 90% of all venture capital goes to straight white men, and they make up, you all make up about a third of the population in the United States. So it already doesn't make any sense logically. And then, anecdotally, you walk into a room, you are a person of color, you're the CEO of a company, but you're with your white employee, and this has happened to me multiple times, and you're automatically considered not, you can't be the CEO, you can't be the founder of the company, the other person must be. And, you know, it runs the gamut from that to even more insulting things that happen every day.
What's your... So look, truth to power here, right? What's your sense that you are going to be able to change that? I mean, obviously you've been successful. You've been successful as far as you've gone now in this field, but you know, you walk up and down Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, where all the big tech VCs are, and you are not going to find a lot of people like you.
That's true. and it's unfortunate, but because I'm great. But I am optimistic because 5 years ago, when I reached out to people in Silicon Valley, investors, white men, and said I was a gay black woman looking to raise a fund, I was literally told, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about race, gender. Now you can't go anywhere without hearing about it. And I think people are just finally getting seen and noticed where they had been overlooked for so long.
Speaking of Silicon Valley, I mean, there's a lot of tips, a lot of guidance in this book, a lot of things for people to think about. The one that is most resonant to me really is that you don't have to play to the stereotypes of Silicon Valley of all-nighters and life hacks and broism, right, and all of that stuff. How do you step away from that if that's the world you're operating in or near?
I think people that talk about that, who say if you're not doing all-nighters, you're not doing it right. I don't know if they have kids. I don't know what exactly their setup is that lets them do that, but that's not the real world. And I wanted to be able to do something sustainable in the real world. So I think about boundaries. Self-care really starts with believing in your own value, and then everything else radiates from that.
With the caveat that, you know, it's tough to repeat somebody else's life cycle, for those who are listening who I guess are motivated by this, how did you do it? Because it has to be said, you were living, you know, you were with your single mom, you were on food stamps, and you made it happen. How? What was the break? Or did you make the break?
Yeah, I think it was a combination. I say in the book that no one is self-made, in my opinion. My thing was, I made a decision in 2014 that this fund that invests in underrepresented founders had to exist with or without me. And so once I had that locked in, there was going to be no stopping me, even through some of the, you know, the really tough times personally.
So look, speaking of tough times, not personally, but for the entire planet, how do you see this moment affecting this mission that you're on?
Well, I think that underrepresented founders, so women, people of color, LGBTQ, who I invest in, they're being affected by what's going on, even more so in the venture space, at least. And I think venture capital in general is going to struggle over the next 12 to 24 months acutely. And then of those startups who are often misunderstood themselves, the ones who are underrepresented are even worse off, because we have to build these networks from the ground up in order to get in the room and to get in these spaces. And now it's like we have to start all over there. Again, I'm optimistic, though, because this is where people who have been overlooked often shine, is when they are challenged, because frankly, we're used to it. And we there's a resilience there that I think is lacking elsewhere.
Arlena Hamilton, she's a founder and CEO of a company called Backstage Capital, also an author now of a book called It's About Damn Time. Arlen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We've got an excerpt from Arlen's book at our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
Who wants to build up a $50,000 emergency room bill that you can't pay after it's all said and done?
Well, nobody wants to. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 133 today, 0.5%, 23,883. The NASDAQ up 98, that's about 1.1%, 8809. The S&P 500, 25 points to the good, 0.9%, 28.68 there. Oil prices bubbled up a bit today as some economies start to reopen. West Texas crude rose more than 20%, just about $24.56 a barrel, should you be in the market. So energy companies pumped up today. Chevron revved up more than 4.25%. Royal Dutch Shell up about 6.5% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 0.66%. And you, yeah, no, you, right there. You're listening to Marketplace. You got questions, we help you answer them. That's why you listen to Marketplace, especially now, right? When you really want to make sure you are getting information you can trust. As a nonprofit news organization, our public service mission is to deliver reliable, independent news that makes you smarter about this economy. And in return, we ask for your support. Any donation makes you a Marketplace investor, and every investor makes a difference. So please donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, we can talk reopening the economy until the cows come home, but there are some questions to be answered as stores that aren't like supermarkets or pharmacies get going again. Retailers, mostly, is what I'm talking about. But how? That's the key question. How do you start things back up again in the middle of a pandemic that is still going strong? Marketplace's Mario Segura has that one.
Think about what used to happen when you walked into a clothing store. You were greeted by someone, probably standing less than 6 feet away. You'd browse the racks, touch a bunch of things. Then you'd grab an armful of pants or shirts, try 10 things on, hand 9 of them back, and head to the register where you'd interact closely with a cashier. All of this will have to change. Kimberly Pedrick owns a small clothing and jewelry store in New Haven, Connecticut called Idiom. She says the precautions will start at the door.
I plan to have a hand sanitizing section in the front.
And to make people use it. Customers will also have to wear face coverings. And she's removing the racks from the middle of the store to help people stay away from each other. The fitting rooms will be open.
My hope is if everybody uses a sanitizer upon entry and wears a face mask the entire time they're in the store, even when they're trying something on, that hopefully that'll minimize the amount of exposure to the garments.
She might also set aside clothes that customers try on for some period of time, just in case. That's something big retailers like Macy's and Nordstrom are doing. Stores are also putting up plexiglass barriers at their registers. And Nellie Brown, an expert on workplace safety at Cornell, says retailers could consider posting signs that say,
you know, please don't touch an item unless you truly are interested in buying it, or if it's a piece of clothing, you know, if you're truly interested in looking at it.
You know, this is not sounding very fun. And that's something to keep in mind right now. If you're feeling pent up at home and hoping that soon you'll be able to go shopping as a recreational activity, that's not what it's going to be like for a while. I'm Marielle Segura for Marketplace.
There's a pretty delicate balancing act playing out right now between people and politicians who are really kind of done with quarantine and public health experts who are really kind of worried about a new surge in infections. One of the things we don't have yet that we need to prevent that for sure is enough tests. Companies that make those tests and their components have gone into 24/7 production. So what do you suppose it's like on the inside to be an essential worker at an essential company making essential components of essential tests? Marketplace's Scott Tong spent a couple of weeks getting to know workers at a plant in the Washington, D.C. area, getting to know them on Zoom, yes, learning why they signed on to be what you might call corporate first responders.
About 30 miles north of D.C., in the leafy suburb of Germantown, Maryland, you'll find a small campus-like complex. It's part of the international biotech company QIAGEN. Inside, Javet Bass-Perry is a lab manager. Every day, she gowns up for safety.
So hair nets, safety glasses, lab coats, face masks.
QIAGEN makes a kit in a box with chemicals and specialty bottles. It's a critical piece of the testing chain. The kit processes a biological sample, you know, mucus and a swab, and pulls out the genetic material to look for virus. Javet's husband Jonathan works there too. He mixes chemicals for the kit.
We actually deliver those to Javet's area, and she actually puts those into the individual containers that go into the actual kits.
He works in close quarters with his colleagues, which is risky, but to him, this fight is somewhat personal.
both of our parents are in their 70s, and I guess being African-American, I can see the nobility in trying to make sure we do everything we can.
So far, COVID-19 infection and death rates are notably higher for African-Americans. In March, QIAGEN began mobilizing its Maryland plant for mass production, hiring new people and adding shifts. For Javay and Jonathan, it meant longer workdays in their current lab jobs. So now they had a decision to make. What to do with their boys, ages 4 and 9?
We had considered initially to send our boys to live with John's parents in North Carolina. But if you left the state, you had to be quarantined and all these other things. And we had decided, you know what, no, we have to stay together.
So they did. And their home schedule went bonkers.
I am homeschooling in the morning from 7 to 10. And then I come to work and I work from 10 to 7:30.
Part of her day job is to train new hires while keeping that 6-foot safety gap. She knows the risk. A QIAGEN colleague died last month of COVID-19 after returning from a cruise. Inside the lab, two of her colleagues spend all day wiping down doorknobs and countertops. Everyone wears a mask. And the big change everyone's told me about? Lunch in the company cafeteria. Just one person per table now, everyone facing the same direction. It's like school, says lab worker Steve Canoni.
Now you have to kind of sit at a table and feel like we're taking our SAT test again.
Yet for all the planning and precautions, QIAGEN has hit a snag. It's run into shortages of chemicals and the special containers that hold them. International operations head Sean Augerson says the whole industry is swamped by global demand.
Well, when you have a supply chain globally that just explodes, you're not going to get those raw materials because your vendor is not going to be prepared to send it to you because you're saying, I need a year's worth next week.
So for now, his team makes all the partial kits that it can, just not the final product.
We're hoping that we can do stuff by end of May. It's more looking in the June timeframe because we don't have some of these different pieces. And I want to be able to get in this fight as soon as we can.
There's another headache. When a lab machine breaks down, the vendor can't come over to fix it. It's too risky to bring in outsiders. So they explain stuff on video, says QIAGEN scientist Henry Butler. It wastes valuable time, but he feels driven to do his job.
You know, it could be your family member who needs this kit you're going to make tomorrow. Or it could be you yourself who needs to get tested.
At the end of each workday, Jonathan Perry picks up his boys at daycare and cooks dinner. His wife, Javay, gets home about 8.
As soon as we come in the door, we bag our clothes, we take showers.
They need to protect themselves from the pandemic they're fighting. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Second maybe only to masks and personal protective equipment, the thing people really need in this pandemic? Health insurance. For people who can't get coverage through their jobs, there's the Affordable Care Act. Catches the enrollment period for coverage on the federal government's insurance marketplace closed in December and isn't reopening. Some states have their own Obamacare insurance exchanges, and about a dozen or so extended their deadlines for the people who needed it in this crisis. Veronica Zaragovia looked into how that's been going.
For Paris Barnes in Baltimore City, work these days sounds something like this.
Healthcare Access Maryland, this is Paris. How may I help you?
And the client would then at that point tell me what they need from me.
Barnes is a healthcare navigator. She helps people figure out the best coverage plan to meet their needs and their budget through Maryland's exchange. It's a job she's done for 6 years, but now many people are bringing up COVID-19 concerns.
They're just simply afraid that if they don't have anything, will they be denied treatment or will they not receive fair treatment or will they not be able to be screened?
She says her new clients are younger. Most of Maryland's enrollees this new period range from age 26 to 34. Many work in restaurants or in other jobs that often don't offer health benefits. Trish Riley is with the National Academy for State Health Policy.
It's a health plan that's accessible and available to gig workers, to self-employed people, to individuals. And I think that's why we see the influx of enrollment.
Take Nevada's marketplace. State data show it had about 680 enrollees in February. And by March, that was up to 1,900. These enrollees include Chase Lee in Las Vegas. He's 24, and until recently he had 2 restaurant jobs, but no health insurance coverage. And before the pandemic, he had no plans to buy insurance. But his parents got on his case.
My dad kept telling me, make sure you get insurance with this going on. Who wants to, you know, build up a $50,000 emergency room bill that you can't pay after it's all said and done?
So he turned to a navigator at the Las Vegas Asian Community Resource Center when Nevada reopened its exchange.
If it wasn't for the COVID-19, I wouldn't have an option but to wait the entire year to try and get open enrollment next November.
He chose one that costs $55 a month. It's a low-level plan that has an affordable monthly premium. But that requires higher out-of-pocket payments to meet a deductible before the coverage kicks in. And in the past, that has been a barrier for some low-income people, says Alok Sarwal with the Colorado Alliance for Health Equity and Practice in Denver.
They're affording the insurance it's a trade-off. Now, their priority and risk is so high, it's a life and death decision that they are forced to buy insurance. So those are really very sobering facts for them.
States that have reopened enrollment do have deadlines. Maryland's enrollment is scheduled to close June 15th. I'm Veronica Saragovia for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, another telling data point from the latest Marketplace Edison Research poll. One of the things we always ask people is how they're feeling about the prospects of getting another job should they lose the one they've got. Last time we did this poll, it was a year ago, only 11% of people said they were not at all confident they would be able to get another job. Now, more than double, 24% of people say they doubt they'd be able to get another job if they lost theirs today. So there is that. Also, the April unemployment report comes out Friday morning. All right, we got to go. Here's a bit of context on the way out, perhaps more useful in our present circumstance than what Wall Street does on any given day. We learned this morning that the service sector in this economy, which accounts for about 2/3 of GDP, gross domestic product, we learned it shrank for the first time since 2009. You want recession indicators? That's a pretty good one. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.